Hi, I'm Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW, and I want to invite you to become a member of KALW. We are 70% listener supported, so as you listen to this, please make sure to go to the Donate Now button at KALW.org. Thanks.
KALW.
It's a very hard time to be a farm worker in this moment.
California is burning, but the state's farm workers are still going to work, risking their health to pick grapes, lettuce, and strawberries.
Farm workers can't afford food that they pick for the rest of us.
We'll hear from activists who worry that 2020's historic combination of disasters is also fueling labor abuses. Then a local author brings readers personal stories from people with disabilities.
This book is a snapshot of the disabled experience is like.
And we'll hear a reading from a new coming-of-age novel.
It's about a girl named Layla who's having a hard time growing up and accidentally releases a viral video where she describes the biome of inside her home.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. California was struck by lightning nearly 12,000 times last month. The storm sparked a series of wildfires that have burned over 1 million acres in the past few weeks. A lot of these fires are in farm country, and from Santa Rosa to Salinas, farm workers are still going to work, risking heat, smoke, and COVID-19 to go pick grapes and harvest strawberries. Activists are worrying that 2020's historic combination of disasters is also causing labor abuses. KALW's Teresa Katsarilis drove up to Sonoma County to learn more.
It's 11 p.m. on a Monday night, and Zeke Guzman is driving through the back roads of wine country. Sonoma County's COVID-19 infection rate landed it on the state's watch list, so we're both wearing N95 masks, trying our best to somehow keep our distance in the car. When we're outside of Healdsburg, Zeke waves a hand at the vineyards out the window.
Zinfandels, Cabernets, Merlots, Petit Syrahs, and there's fire still going on over there, see?
Zeke points to this shock orange glow between two black hills. It's part of the LNU Lightning Complex fire, which has killed 5 people and burned over 500 square miles in the North Bay so far. We're right outside the mandatory evacuation zone.
I don't think I've ever seen a fire this close before.
Like, oh my gosh, this is nothing.
Zeke's out tonight in his role as president of Latinos Unidos. He points to a floodlight in a nearby vineyard. There's harvesting going on there, he says.
You see right there?
Oh, wow.
Right here? They're just starting. They're starting late.
We pull up alongside the rows of grapes. Have you finished up for the night? He asks a farm worker next to a massive haul of grapes. Her face is covered with a bandana. Do you have masks and everything you need? Yes, yes, she assures him. Everything's fine. And this is why Zeke and other labor advocates are driving along the edge of a wildfire's mandatory evacuation zone in the middle of the night. They're trying to check in with workers directly and witness any labor violations in the fields firsthand. COVID-19 is working its way through Latinx communities. Wildfire smoke is settling over Northern California, and Zeke thinks farm workers just aren't getting the basic safety gear they need. Zeke used to be a farm worker himself. When he was a kid, his dad marched with Cesar Chavez and used to spray pesticides on prune trees without protective gear.
All he did was put a cap and sunglasses on.
Zeke says he thinks the job's actually gotten harder since then.
It's a very hard time to be a farm worker in this moment.
David Hornig is senior safety engineer with California's Division of Occupational Safety and Health, also known as Cal OSHA. He's the agency's heat and agricultural program coordinator, and he says farm workers face an unprecedented series of challenges this year.
Farm work is the most dangerous job, arguably, in California, always. Their fatality rate is 5 times that of general industry. You've got the climate change making our summers hotter, and then on top of that, you've got COVID-19 and all of the hazards related to that. And then on top of that, you've got the wildfire smoke.
These disasters aren't just happening all at once. They feed into each other. Take COVID-19. Farm workers are particularly at risk here. They're essential workers who often live in overcrowded housing. Sometimes they commute to work in jam-packed buses or vans. Now that fire season started, advocates like Zeke Guzman expect infections to go up. A lot of farm workers evacuated to friends and family's homes rather than official evacuation centers, which makes living conditions even more crowded. And studies suggest wildfire smoke could make people more vulnerable to COVID-19. Cal OSHA's David Hornig says we have laws that should help keep workers safe through all this.
Obviously, we have our new regulation that started last year to protect workers from wildfire smoke.
Employers have to offer workers N95 masks when the air quality gets bad enough. The state also regulates how long you can work outdoors in extreme heat without water or breaks. And employers need to have a plan in place to protect workers from COVID-19. But labor advocates say they're already hearing stories about vineyards that aren't following those rules.
The accounts we're hearing are very scattered because everyone's either working around the clock or they're concerned with evacuation.
Omar Paz is the lead organizer for North Bay Jobs with Justice, a Sonoma County nonprofit. He says in the chaos after the LNU Lightning Complex fire started, a former farm worker he knows got in touch with him. The worker said he had family members who were still picking grapes in two vineyards outside of Healdsburg. They were being pressured to bring in the harvest fast.
Masks weren't being provided. The ones that were surgical, not N95s.
Which means farm workers weren't protected from wildfire smoke. In a recent interview, Sonoma County's agricultural commissioner, Adam Smith, said he hadn't directly heard about these allegations. But workers and labor organizations have made similar claims throughout California's farm country. The United Farm Workers Foundation says 84% of the workers they polled recently had not been given N95 masks by their employers. And Cal OSHA has received several complaints about hazardous wildfire conditions on farms in the past few weeks. Employers and employees are incentivized to work through these conditions. For the people who own these vineyards, this is the beginning of harvest season. Wine is a multi-billion dollar industry here, and wildfire smoke could taint the grapes if they're not picked quickly. For farm workers, well, in California, they make an average of $18,000 a year. Vineyard workers are paid piece rate. Zeke Guzman says they make between $125 and $150 for every ton of grapes they pick. So the more you pick, the more money you make. And Omar says this dovetails with another disaster farm workers are up against this year, the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic.
People had cashed out their life savings. Their money under their mattresses was gone.
When the pandemic started, it shut down the entire food service industry. Restaurants shut down, so did school cafeterias. California's growers lost billions of dollars. And that trickled down to farm workers, who started losing work too. Now, on top of that, more people are competing for the farm jobs that are available. Omar says people who lost service industry jobs are heading out to the fields for the first time.
We have people working in back of the house restaurants and waitressing, things like that, who are for the first time entering the fields, and you know, they're clunking along, they're learning on the fly, and we have people who are willing to take pay cuts without concern for safety issues, any sort of income they can get.
Local officials, nonprofits, and business leaders are trying to make this situation better. Nonprofit leaders and Sonoma County's Agricultural Commissioner's Office distributed thousands of N95 masks to farm workers. A coalition of community organizations also helped farm workers evacuate and get the resources they need. In the meantime, advocates like Omar Paz and Zeke Guzman are connecting with farm workers and documenting their accounts of labor violations. Zeke's also looking ahead to the next crisis. The wildfires mean workers might lose their jobs or homes, he says. That means they'll lose even more money. And while California just extended its rental moratorium, the threat of eviction is still hanging over many people. As we drive back to Healdsburg from the fields, Zeke lets out a sigh.
Farm workers can't afford food that they pick for the rest of us.
If that basic inequity isn't addressed, he says, workers will keep risking their health in the fields, and there will always be employers who are willing to take advantage of that. In Healdsburg, I'm Teresa Cotsarillis for Cross Currents.
Teresa is KELW's immigration reporter. You can hear more of her stories online at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Alice Wong grew up in Indiana in a Chinese immigrant family. She attended college there, but San Francisco was calling her. Today, she's an activist with a disability who's been recognized by former President Obama, Time magazine, and most recently, British Vogue. Alice founded the Disability Visibility Project in 2014 to amplify disability media and culture. That project led to a podcast and now a book, a collection of personal essays by writers who give their take on living with disabilities today. KALW's Janae Darden caught up with Alice Wong.
You said something that changed your life was the American Disability Act. And you said that basically helped you live the life that you had envisioned for yourself. Where were you at when that came into effect? And what were the changes that you foresaw for yourself?
So I was a sophomore at high school. In 1990, with a long past. And, you know, I have to be really honest, like, I don't remember, like, you know, noticing it. It wasn't something that registered, like, deeply into my brain. You know, it really wasn't until I graduated from high school and needed to go to college that I really realized, like, wow, you know, this law came right in time to really, you know, ensure that I do have, like, the ability to request reasonable accommodations. It's been a real key in order for me to go to school and get what I need and just have a law that I could call my own.
Mm-hmm.
I just say, hey, this is, you know, something that I would need to perform my daily activities and just not have to beg for it, even though I think the experience now is still very difficult. You know, a law doesn't change the world, you know. I think it's really about people power.
Okay, so you figured out this life that you wanted. The ADA kind of helped you say, hey, I can make this come true.
Yeah.
Then you told your family, I want to move to California. How did your family feel when you said, I want to move to California?
I think they do. I think it was, I really felt suffocated and stifled in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, hey, like, San Francisco Bay Area is such an epicenter of, like, a huge, vibrant, active disability, you know, community. And, you know, they were the heart of where a lot of independent living movement happened. You have a large community of disabled people, just like, you know, any other community, where, like, when you're seen, it's like, well, like, the vibe is different, you know, you feel it.
You write in your book that people with disabilities are more visible than ever.
Speaking for myself, I think the internet has been a game changer. I think the ability to blog on your own, do you have a Twitter account? There are so many really, really cool, like, disabled and deaf artists and just everyday people just, you know, creating content. We don't need to write an op-ed and just, you know, cross our fingers that the editor won't run it. We could just publish our own stuff. And I think that's given so many marginalized communities a base. Being on social media does have its huge risks. I mean, it is a dumpster fire. Let's, you know.
And that's a mild way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bag of burning poop. I mean, it's, you know, when I talk about visibility, I'm not sugarcoating it. It's not even, like, literal visibility, right? It's about be comfortable in your own skin. But the fact that there are people who are at that place, and they're telling their stories, you know, in many ways, by being visible, hopefully it gives permission to other folks who are just still figuring stuff out. Like, you're not alone, that you're not alone. One of the ways that helps is to see yourself represented in different ways.
I know one thing that's come up for people with disabilities is for a long time, they would ask, you know, when there's events, it's like, can you stream it at, you know, at conferences and stuff? You know, people with disabilities, like, I can't attend. Can you stream it so I can watch it from home? And these organizations would say, oh, we don't have the capacity. That's why I say COVID is a reflection, so much of a reflection of some of the issues in this society. And now people are at home and they can't go out. And now all of these organizations and companies are streaming.
It's super interesting to see when, let's just face it, like, non-disabled people suddenly have something taken away from them. Oh, this is unfair. Oh, what are we going to do? Oh my gosh, this is, I can't believe this. We got to do something. You know, suddenly there's capacity. When disabled people ask and tell people, hey, this is problematic or this is inaccessible, usually a few things either happen. Like, usually we're not believed, we're complaining, we're asking for too much. I think, again, the pandemic has shown, like, suddenly everybody is, you know, impacted, and they're just making things happen without really acknowledging the years of advocacy by sick and disabled people. What's also really telling during this pandemic, what kinds of people are disposable, right? I mean, this pandemic has really shown,
yes,
very much the racist and xenophobic ableist, you know, how we really feel about the people in our community, right? Like this, it's all seen as this, like, acceptable loss, right? Like, nobody's, like, we don't see the country really responding and really acknowledging the systemic inequality. I mean, you see people in prisons and nursing homes dying at alarming rates, And why don't we give a shit about people who are behind bars? I mean, it's because we can't see them. It's because they're separate from us. And when you have a system that perpetuates segregation, it allows us to devalue people or just render them as invisible. And this is Black, brown, older people, disabled people, it's all, you know, interconnected.
Yeah. This conversation has taken an intersectional turn, and your book is super intersectional. Super intersectional. I mean, it's about, of course, living with disability. It's about race. It's about class. It's about gender. I mean, it's just so culture, religion. I mean, it's so intersectional. What have you learned from this book?
Oh, well, thank you so much for noticing that. And, you know, I wanted to show, not tell. What I've learned is that, you know, for me, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This book is just one of many books out there by disabled people. But I think there's room for so much more. I think, for me, this book is a snapshot of the disabled experience is like for some people in our current time period. You know, there are some very serious pieces, but there's a lot of beauty and joy as well. And I think we don't see enough joy. You know, I think one of the ways we do stay alive is finding joy in one another. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is what's helped me is the relationships I have with people. Needing time for myself, needing desserts. But yeah, we have to make space for joy, and we have to take pleasure in what we can. Because there is joy in being disabled. I think that goes against almost every major kind of idea.
Yes, it
does. Or narrative or portrayal. If you actually talk to people who have these disabilities, it's like, I'm just living my life the best way I can. You know, just like everybody else. It's really the oppression and the low expectations people have of us that's really super, super toxic. And, you know, that's what needs to be dismantled.
That was activist Alice Wong speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Alice's book is Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. Find more information about it at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Bay Area authors have had to cancel launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus, so KALW is bringing them to you in a series we're calling New Arrivals. Today, Oakland author Meg Elison reads from her book, Find Layla.
It's about a girl named Layla who's having a hard time growing up and accidentally releases a viral video where she describes the biome of inside her home, which is very different from the home she knows because there are mushrooms growing inside her brother's dresser and mold growing up the walls. My name is Layla Bailey, and this is my biome. I cut to the footage of my house, turning up the audio so that I can be heard explaining my habitat. I added today's men in plastic suits to the very end, and I narrate over it. These people in CPS are the apex predators of my ecosystem, and I am an endangered species, the last of my kind. But the Sierra Club doesn't make posters out of kids like me. I add three screenshots near the end. The first is the only picture of my mom I could find, in profile and wreathed in smoke. This is my mother, Darlene Thompson. She was born in captivity and released into the wild without any skills to care for herself. She is missing. If you see her, do not attempt to approach her, but please contact animal control. The second is Andy. This is Andrew Fisher Bailey, my little brother. He was taken into captivity 2 days ago by people he had never seen before. I don't know his whereabouts, but I hope he's safe. If you see him, remember he is friendly but skittish. He is better off in captivity than in the wild. The last one is my most recent report card, accessed on the school's website by inputting the username and password I created for my mom last year. This is me, Layla Louise Bailey. I was born in the wild and cannot be domesticated. However, I'm not yet fully capable of caring for myself either. I have no money and not enough skills. What I have is a 4.0 and really low standards. I'll do chores, I'll be quiet. If you've got a garage or a laundry room I could sleep in, I am mostly housebroken. I just want to finish school, adopt my little brother, and go to college.
That was Meg Elison reading from her new book, Find Layla. Find more information about it at kalw.org/newarrivals. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.